Chapter 7. It was the honor of the Death Guard that they be the first Astartes to set foot on the surface of Istvan III in the mission to restore the world to compliance. Ulis Temeter's heart swelled with martial pride to know that he and the men of his company would form the very point of the spear tip. The captain's drop pod hammered into the compacted mudflats adjoining the Coral City's trench lines with a solid thunder of torn earth. The concussion of the landing echoed over and over as hundreds more pods rained from the sky in burning red-orange streaks, half burying themselves in the dirt. The invasion force numbered in the thousands, with warriors of every rank and stripe coming in hard, cold fury to the surface. In the minds of each Astartes, there was anger and censure for the rebels, and the Death Guard were but a part of the multiple brigades of warriors and war machines turned to that purpose. The flanks of Temeter's pod flew open, propelled by explosive bolts, and he took his first breath of Istvanian air to call out to his men, "For Terra and Mortarion!" The captain led his command squad out of the shallow crater their landing had created and opened fire, laying down a chattering fan of tracer against a group of turncoat soldiers who had ventured close to observe. Vardus Prowl had prepared his defences well, gutting the forest that had previously stood in this place and making the flat landscape into a sparse killing ground of trenches, tunnels and low bunkers. Beyond it, a few kilometres distant, were the outskirts of the Coral City itself. The cool, blue-white sunlight of the day made it glitter and shine. Temeter saw more streaks of fire descending on the city proper, towards the striking shapes of the Precentor's Palace and the Siren Hold, the drop-pod assault elements of the World Eaters, Emperor's Children and Sons of Horus. He smiled. The Death Guard would meet them soon enough, but first he had a punishment to mete out. The traitor Prahl's men had fashioned these earthworks in defiance of the Emperor's call to obedience, and it was Captain Temeter's duty to show them the error of their ways. It would have been a simple matter for the Astartes invasion force to bypass the trench lines and land behind them, but to do that would have sent the wrong message. It would have implied that the fortifications were somehow a challenge to Imperial might, when clearly they were nothing more than a minor impediment. So, Temeter and the Death Guard would walk into the fire corridors of the Istvanian lines. They would rend and destroy them, and march on to the Coral City to show these deluded fools the truth. Nothing could stand in the way of the Emperor's will. The Astartes moved across the dull mud in a thick line of marble grey and green armour, a heavy wave of ceramite and flex steel fording snarls of razor wire and barriers made of rough-cut tree trunks. They strode through kill points and shrugged off hails of stubber bullets. Some of Temeter's troops paused here and there as they found concealed pop-up hatches and closed them permanently with melter bombs. The captain glanced back and saw the venerable dreadnought Huron Fowl moving to his right flank, the spread clawed feet of the hulking warrior churning up the mud. Sprays of fire from the twin-mounted cannons on Huron's right arm lanced out and blew huge divots of clotted earth from the enemy lines, sending traitor soldiers scattering. The defenders of the Coral City wore drab fatigues that matched the colour of the dull mud, but such pitiful attempts at camouflage were rendered useless by the image intensification lenses and infrared prey sight functions of an Astartes helm. He gave the command in battle sign for the line to split into skirmish parties, and watched as the warriors broke into packs. Temeter knew most of the men in this detachment by name or reputation, although there were some Death Guard here today that he had never fought with. The War Master's deployment plan for the assault, while sound, was not one that Temeter himself would have constructed. Rather than follow the traditional lines of unit by company division, Horus had combed the legions for individual squad-level elements and assembled a force that drew men from dozens of different companies. It was the captain's understanding that this had happened not only with the Death Guard, but also in the World Eaters, the Emperor's children, and Horus's own legion. He had to admit, the strategic thinking behind such a selective deployment was beyond him. But if the War Master had ordered it to be so, then he had no doubt there was a reason for it. Privately, the captain of the Fourth was pleased to have a battlefield to himself for a change, able to fight without taking a back seat to Grolgor's grandstanding or Typhon's brutal tactics. The foe was regrouping, recovering from the shock of the initial landing to the point where their fire was no longer random. Over the flat blares of ballistic shot, Temeter's keen hearing captured scratchy atonal sounds that sounded like singing. He had read the after-action chronicles from Istvan Extremis and knew of these so-called war singers and their strange choral witchery. It seems that here, on the third planet, the arcane power of their peculiar music also held sway. Temeter raised his combi bolter and began a symphony of his own. The Eisenstein was an unremarkable vessel, an older pattern of ship in the frigate tonnage grade, just over 2 kilometres in length from bow to stern. It bore some resemblance to the newer sword-class craft, but only inasmuch as most Imperial ships shared a similar design philosophy. Almost every line vessel in service to the Lord of Terror was constructed of congruent elements. The dagger prow, the massive block of sublight and warp drives, and forged between them amidships of crenellations and complex sheaves of steel. "It doesn't look like much," Voyen remarked quietly, peering through the Stormbird's viewport as they crossed from the Endurance. But he was still wary around Garrow, and it showed in his voice.
"It's just a ship," replied the battle captain. "There or elsewhere, we do our duty no differently."
In the frigate's landing bay, which seemed cramped and narrow in comparison to the Endurance, the ship's master was waiting to greet the Death Guard with a formal bridge party.
"Barrick Karaya," he said, with a clipped accent and a brisk salute. "Commander Grolgor, Battle Captain Garrow. As the Primarch has ordered, this ship is yours until death or new duty."
Karaya was thick-set and tawny, with a matting of stubbly grey hair around his head and chin. Garrow noticed the shine of a carbon-plated augmetic at his cheek and saw the stud plug cords dangling in a queue from the back of his skull. He was terse in manner, but just on the right side of obedient. As ship's master, Karaya would be de facto captain when a ranking Astartes was not on board, and he didn't doubt the man had some resentment about stepping out of that role for this assignment. The shipmaster glanced at the lean, thin-faced woman at his side. Garrow recognised the status pins on her epaulets as those of executive rank.
"My deck officer, Russell Vought."
She bowed and made the sign of the Aquila. Grolgor took this opportunity to sniff in slight disdain.
"You may carry on, shipmaster. When Captain Garrow or I require your attention, you will be made aware of it."
Karaya and Vought saluted and left. Garrow watched them go, aware that Grolgor was already attempting to place himself in a position of superiority less than a minute after they had stepped onto Eisenstein's decks. He looked back towards the aura field, holding out the vacuum of space, as the last of the Stormbirds drifted into the landing bay on darts of blue thrust, angling to land next to the transports assigned to the elements from the 2nd and 7th companies. A momentary crease of uncertainty crossed Garrow's face. He counted the Stormbirds. Surely the new arrival was one too many for their needs. It wasn't as if the entirety of their commands had come with the 2 unit leaders. The ship settled and folded its raptor wings to its fuselage. The captain watched it from the corner of his eye, waiting for the embarkation hatch to drop open to release more of Grolgor's men. But it remained static. There were no passengers aboard then? Perhaps the ship only carried inanimate cargo. Grolgor crossed his line of sight and showed Garrow a thin, humourless smile.
I intend to make an inspection of this vessel to ensure it is fully prepared for the battle.
Very well.
The commander signaled to a handful of his men and strode away without looking back. Garrow sighed and turned to Caleb, where the housecarl stood, bowed.
Supervise the Eisenstein servitors to unload our war gear and equipment.
He paused.
And report to me any information about the payload from that last Stormbird.
Aye, Lord. I'll have the crew install the gear on the frigate's arming racks.
Garrow looked at Sergeant Haker.
Anders, take the men and find us a good billet before Grolgor's men take the choice spaces.
Off the veteran's salute, the battle captain turned to his command squad.
I'm going to the bridge. Decius Sendek, you'll join me.
Voyan gave him a look.
While Grolgor stalks the lower decks, forgive me, Lord, but I find something about his manner unsettling.
Who doesn't? Offered Sendek. He's your superior, apothecary,
Garrow said, more bluntly than he had intended.
He has the authority to do as he wishes within reason.
Nathaniel waved Voyan away.
Go with Haker. I'm in no mood for idle speculation at this moment.
With his warriors following him, Garrow walked to the elevator platform that would take them up to the frigate's central tiers. He kept his face neutral, but Voyan had struck a sore point. It would be divisive and unseemly for the battle captain to have spoken openly in front of Line Astartes. But the truth was, Garrow too suspected an ulterior motive on Grulgor's part.
Have we come to this? His thoughts echoed in his mind. When men of the same legion cannot look upon one another without a bloom of distrust. There is rivalry between warriors, and then there is enmity. And this, what am I sensing?
Captain!
Temeter looked up into the face of one of his junior officers.
Sir, our approach on the northern flank is being forced into a bottleneck. The defenders have a twinned quad-barrel cannon sweeping the area. It is emplaced in a ferrocrete bunker. Shall I give the command to go around?
Temeter snorted.
We are Death Guard, lad. When we encounter a boulder in our path, we do not slink and flow around it like water. We strike and shatter it.
He rose and beckoned his command squad with him.
Show me this impediment.
They moved low over undulating ground, leaping over shallow trenchworks clogged with Esvanian dead and shell casings. The crack and screech of shots whizzed around them, and still Temeter heard the doleful droning dirges of the enemy. Crossing a shallow incline, the captain deliberately stepped out of line and stomped on a fallen speaker horn where it had fallen from a support pole. The device sparked and fell silent.
There, Lord,
said the officer. It was a flat hexagon set deep in the grey mud, the clean shade of ferrocrete not more than a few years old. Pits were being dug in the fascia of it from bolt rounds as Death Guard sharpshooters sniped from cover. As the young Astartes had said, the wicked barrels of the quad guns were spitting an endless stream of tracer out over the approaches. A handful of broken bodies in the killing zone showed where battle brothers had advanced and died in the attempt. Temeter frowned.
Shot and shell won't do the deed. Bring up the men with flamers and plasma weapons.
The order was relayed, and a troop of Death Guard carrying inferno guns came forward. Temeter tossed his combi bolter to the young officer and beckoned another man closer.
Your torch. Give it to me.
The captain took the warrior's flamer and shook it, hearing the satisfying slosh of a near full tank of liquid promethium.
Bolters, draw their attention. Flamers, give them the heat.
The Astartes opened fire, and as Temeter expected, the heavy quad guns inched around to track on them. His men understood the plan without the need for him to lay it out in detail. The moment the quads were depressed, the Death Guard with flamer and plasma weapons crested their cover and sent jets of superheated gas and burning fluid washing over the sides of the bunker and into the interior. The defenders couldn't range the guns back fast enough, and within moments, Temeter had led his men to the very wall of the low blockhouse.
For good measure, he had a sergeant toss a fist of crack grenades through the aiming slot and then projected himself up and over the bunker roof. Temeter ran and dropped down into the S-shaped entry tunnel, smashing a hooded trooper into the ferrocrete with an ugly crack of bone. He heard the confusion inside the dugout and waded into it. Within, black smoke and licks of guttering fire clung to the walls, and the heat radiating from the thrumming quad guns was thick. The captain triggered the borrowed flamer and hosed it across the space before him, a hissing red whip of flame carving through the air at chest height. Men became torches, and boxes of unspent ammunition in compartments below cooked off in blaring detonations. One of the Istvanian soldiers ran at him, shrieking and aflame, and pulled Temeter into an embrace. The captain let the flamer drop from his grip and ripped the man in two, tearing him apart. He beat out the flames and grimaced as the rest of his troop waded in and finished the task. The bunker silenced, Temeter glanced into the tunnel mouths that branched downward from it. "Seal all of these," he ordered. "We don't want rats popping up behind us after our line advances past this point." Without the roar of the cannons, once again the captain became aware of the reedy caterwauling issuing from a vox speaker. He punched it into pieces with his fist. "Destroy those repeaters wherever you see them," Temeter continued. "That oath-forsaken noise is damaging my calm." "Sir," called one of the men, pointing out through the gunslit. Temeter saw a huge shadow dropping towards the horizon on pillars of retro rocket fire, and then felt the earth tremble like a struck bell. Every Astartes in the bunker left the floor for a split second, and he heard the ferrocrete roof crack with the shockwave. The captain peered out and saw a massive cylinder standing upright in a shroud of steam, some distance beyond the zone where the drop pods had put down. It was easily the size of a Hive City habitat block, guidance fins still glowing cherry red with the heat of re-entry. There came a mighty moan of stressed metals, and the sides of the cylinder fell away, trailing flexible pipes and streams of white vapour. From inside the monstrous drop capsule came the hooting call of a battle horn, and then planes of steel and iron emerged from the smoke to become a colossus, bristling with armour and guns. The ground resonated with each thunderous footfall as the Imperator-class Titan strode out towards the Coral City. "Dies Irae," said Temeter, naming the massive war machine. "Our cousins from the Legio Mortis have decided to join our outing." He allowed himself to marvel at the huge battle construct, then shook it off. "Signals," he called. "Contact the Irae's princeps and update him on the battle situation." The young Astartes officer handed Temeter back his combi bolter and frowned.
"Lord, there is a concern with the Vox."
"Explain," he demanded.
"We're having difficulty making contact on some channels, including the feed to the Titan and our ships in orbit."
Temeter glanced up.
"Are the locals jamming us?"
The Astartes shook his head.
"I don't believe so, Captain. The dropout's too selective for that. It's as if certain Vox frequencies have just been switched off."
He accepted this with a brisk nod.
"We'll work around it, then. If the problem gets worse, then inform me. Otherwise, we proceed with the attack plan as determined."
Temeter bounded out of the cloying air of the dead bunker and strode forward.
"On to the Coral City," he called.
A vast shadow hove above him, and the captain looked up to see the underside of the Dies Irae's foot as it passed over him, descending to fall upon another bunker some distance ahead. The heavy impacts of artillery were starting to converge, coming down in twists of smoke.
"Death Guard,"
he called, shouldering his bolter.
"We'll let the giant take the brunt of the big guns. Into the trenches, brothers. Sweep the ground clean of these rebellious scum."
Karaya looked up as the brass leaves of the bridge iris whispered open to admit Garrow and his two warriors. The man shot a quick, nervous look across at the woman, Vought, and then put up the mask of sullen authority that he had worn in the landing bay.
"Battle, Captain, on the bridge,"
he intoned and saluted. Garrow accepted the honour with a nod.
Ceremony was appeased down below, Master Karaya. Let's not overburden ourselves with it here, and stick to the necessities instead, yes?
As you wish, Captain. Are you going to take the con?
He shook his head.
Not without good reason.
Garrow took in the layout of the ship's command chamber. It was unornamented, as was fitting to the lean and spare intentions of a vessel in the service of the Death Guard. Unlike some starships, where decorative panels of wood or metal covered the walls, the Eisenstein's conduits and workings were bare to the eye. Twisted snarls of cables and piping ranged around the bridge space, clustering around cogitator consoles and viewports. They reminded Garrow of the gnarled roots of ancient trees. Vought seemed to catch on to Garrow's train of thought.
"This vessel may not be pretty, but it has a strong heart, Captain. It's been an unswerving servant of the Emperor since the day it left the lunar shipyards, before I was born."
He noticed how she was careful not to look directly at his injured leg. Even under his power armor, the stiffness in his gait made the aftermath of his recent injury obvious. Garrow put a hand on the central Navitrix podium, studying the etheric compass enclosed in a sphere of glass and suspensor fields. A discreet gunmetal plaque fixed to the podium's base showed the ship's name, class, and details of the frigate's launching. Nathaniel read it to himself and felt amusement tug at his lips.
Fascinating. It seems the Eisenstein took to space in the same year I became an Astartes.
He glanced at Vought.
I have a kinship with her already.
The deck officer returned his smile, and for the first time Garrow felt a moment of genuine connection with a member of the crew.
Eisenstein, ventured Sendek, rolling the word over his lips. It is a word from an old Terran dialect of the Germani. It means ironstone. It is fitting.
Karaya nodded.
Your warrior is correct, Captain Garrow. It also shares its name with two noted men from the Age of Terror. One a remembrancer, the other a scientist.
Such history for a mere frigate,
Decius opined. The shipmaster's eyes flashed for an instant.
With respect, Lord, in the War Master's military there is no such thing as a mere frigate.
Forgive my battle brother, said Garrow mildly. He has grown too comfortable in the spacious bunks aboard the Endurance.
A fine ship, Karaya replied. We'll do well to match the battle record of so illustrious a vessel.
Garrow smiled slightly.
We're not here to win accolades, shipmaster, just to do our duty.
He approached the front of the bridge, where rows of consoles and operator pulpits glowed with the actinic blue of picked screens.
And what is our status?
At station keeping, said Vought. The War Master's orders were to hold at these coordinates until all Astartes were aboard, then await further commands.
The battle captain nodded.
I'm afraid that we may not be making much history today. Our Primarch has ordered that we maintain orbit here at high anchor and watch for enemy ships that may attempt to escape Istvan III under cover of the ground assault.
Garrow had barely finished speaking when a bell chime sounded from a shadowed nook off to the starboard side of the bridge. A heavy sound curtain was bunched up to one side of the dim recess, held open by a thick silver cord. It was a vox-eyed, an alcove where important communications could be received in relative privacy during combat operations. A gangly young officer wearing a complex signalling collar and holding a data slate in his hand stepped out into the light and snapped to attention.
A machine call message. Prioris cipher. Expedite immediate.
He wavered, looking between Garrow and Karaya, unsure of who to address.
Sir?
The shipmaster offered an open hand.
Let me have it, Mr. Maas.
He glanced at Garrow.
Captain, if you will permit me.
Nathaniel nodded and watched Karaya page quickly through the data.
Ah,
he said after a moment.
It seems Lord Mortarion has decided to make a different use of us. Vought, bring manoeuvring thrusters to standby.
Garrow took the slate as the deck officer carried out her directions.
Is there a problem?
No, sir. New orders.
The shipmaster bent over the helm, servitor, and began giving out a string of clipped commands. The data slate was curt and to the point. Directly from the Vox dispatch nexus aboard the Vengeful Spirit, marked with the signet runes of the Death Lord and Horus's equerry, Malaghurst, the fresh directives were for Eisenstein to depart from the current navigation point and drop into a lower orbital path. Like all Astartes of senior rank, Garrow had training and experience in starship operations, and he fell back into the learning drilled into his mind by hypno-conditioning as he read, figuring the status of the frigate once the new coordinates were reached. He frowned. Typhon had told him that Eisenstein was to act as an interceptor for Istvanian absconders, but once settled at this new posting, the ship would be too close to the edge of the third planet's atmosphere to react quickly enough. To function correctly in their assigned role, the frigate had to stay high, giving the gunnery crews time to spot, target, and destroy enemy ships. The drop in altitude only narrowed their field of fire. Then he studied the corresponding planetary coordinates, and his concern deepened. The orbital shift would put the Eisenstein directly over the Coral City, and Garrow was certain that no void-capable craft had been left intact down there. He handed the slate back to Maas, his frown deepening. Had they been carrying drop pods and Astartes for a second assault wave, then the reasoning behind the orders would have been clear. But the frigate was not configured for those sorts of operations. It was, in the most basic sense, only a gun carriage. Decked with weapons batteries that emerged from her flanks in spiky profusion, Eisenstein's only function when ranged so close to a world was one of standoff planetary bombardment. But such an action seemed unthinkable. After all, Horus had already eschewed Angron's demands to blast the Coral City into ashes at the War Council. The War Master would surely not change his mind so quickly. And even if he had, there were hundreds of loyal men down there. Garrow became aware that Karaya was looking at him.
Captain, if you have nothing to add, I'm going to execute the orders.
Garrow nodded distantly, feeling an ill-defined chill wash through him.
Proceed, Master Karaya.
The Death Guard stepped closer to the main viewport and stared out through the armor glass. Beneath him, the cloud-swirled sphere of Istvan III began to drift nearer.
Something wrong, Lord?
Decius spoke in a sub-vocal whisper, below the hearing of the crewmen.
Yes, said the battle captain,
and the sudden honesty of the admission surprised him.
But by Terra, I don't know what it is.
Caleb shrank deep inside the folds of the ship robes and moved with care along the edges of the service gantry. Over the years, he had become quite adept at being unseen in plain sight, and to an outside observer, the house cowl would have resembled nothing but a common serf. His badge of fealty to the Death Guard and the Seventh Company was swaddled beneath the grey material. There was a part of his thoughts that cycled an endless loop of anxious warnings against what he was doing, but Caleb found himself moving forward despite it, going onward. How had he changed so? What he was doing had to be some sort of a criminal act, masquerading as an Eisenstein crewman instead of openly walking with his real identity visible. And yet, he felt filled with the rightness of his actions. Ever since the Emperor had answered Caleb's prayers in the infirmary and saved his master Garrow, the House Carl had become emboldened. His orders were coming from a higher power. Perhaps they always had, but only now was he sure of it. The battle captain had told him to follow the Stormbird's cargo, and he was about it. If it was Garrow's wish, then this was the Emperor's work, and Caleb would be right in doing it. After the men of the Seventh had left the landing bay, Caleb had placed himself where he could give directions to the frigate's servitors, but also observe the last Stormbird. It had only been a few minutes before one of Grolgor's men had returned to the bay, the boorish one, Mokir, and drawn off a work gang of serfs to unload the shuttle's cargo. Caleb watched the heavy steel cubes roll out of the vessel, and then watched the serfs bind them to chain carriages and shift them towards the aft. The containers were identical. Blocks of dull metal, scarred and pitted from use, detailed with the Imperial Aquila and stenciled warning runes in brilliant yellow paint. They could hold anything. From this distance, Caleb could not read the lading scrolls fixed to the flanks. He watched with interest as one of the helot teams fumbled and a crate slipped on its moorings, falling a meter before the men caught the slack and stopped it slamming into the deck. Mokir stormed over to the foreman and backhanded him to the floor. Over the constant noise of the bay, Caleb could not fathom the words he spoke, but the tone of the Death Guard's ill temper was obvious. In a steady train, the crate shifted up and away. Caleb watched them, hesitating. He had orders to supervise the equipment transfer, yes, but Garrow had also demanded information on the nature of the Stormbird's cargo. Caleb convinced himself that the latter was the more important command. So, keeping his distance, the housecarl threaded his way through the Eisenstein, keeping the convoy of containers in sight, careful to stay out of Mokir's eyeline. The crates were halted in the service gantries that ran down the spine of the frigate. On either side of the open steel tunnel were loading gears and hopper mechanisms for the ship's primary weapons batteries. Large open gun breaches lined the walkway, ready to accept war shots from the ammunition magazines that towered above them. The crates were being shifted to the staging areas near the portside guns. Caleb's face showed confusion, and he let his gaze follow the length of one huge cannon out beyond the hull through the armoured slits of the sighting port. He saw the dim reflection of a planetary surface out there, drifting in the dark. The work gangs had some of the crates open, and he shifted forward to get a better look, slipping over the lip of seal plates where wide emergency barrier partitions would drop into place in the event of a munitions discharge or misfire. Caleb's dismay grew stronger when he recognized the tall, broad shapes of Death Guard standing watch over the serfs while they worked. Bareheaded and intent, Commander Grulgor was at their forefront, shouting out orders and giving directions with sharp jerks of his hand. The crate closest to him gave out an oiled hiss and unfolded like a gift box. Inside, there were hexagonal frames, and racked upon them were a dozen glass spheres. Each one was at least a meter in diameter, and all of them were filled with a thick chemical slurry of vomitous green fluids. A black symbol made up of interlocking broken rings decorated each capsule, and some basic animal reaction made Caleb's hands clench around the railing he hid behind. A quick mental calculation told him that if all the crates were identical, then there were over 100 of the spheres in Grulgor's cargo. Things added up. Mokir's abrupt anger, the commander's presence at the unloading, the exaggerated delicacy with which the crewmen moved the capsules. Whatever the liquid was inside them, the glass pods represented something utterly lethal. The thought crystallized in Caleb's mind with such an impact that it pushed him back up to his feet. Suddenly, all the bravery he had felt at his clever little disguise evaporated, and stabs of fear shot through him. The housecarl spun about to run and slammed into an ambling servitor with a tray of tools. The piston-legged machine slave tipped over and collapsed, sending its gear flying. The tool parts sent up a cacophony of sound, drawing the attention of Grulgor's Astartes. Caleb saw Mokir start towards his hiding place, and the housecarl fled into the deeper shadows. Fear enveloped him as readily as the thick material of the ship robes. It was only as his eyes adjusted to the dark that the housecarl realized he had backed into a wide alcove with no other exits. The dead end stopped with a sheer wall of hull metal and hanging catwalks overhead that he couldn't hope to reach. He would be found,
He would be found, and they would know who he was and who had sent him. Nerves in the servant's legs twitched. Grolgor would end his life. He was certain of it. He remembered the look in the commander's eyes back aboard the Endurance, the loathing. But that death would be nothing compared to the crushing failure it represented. Caleb Arryn would die, and he would perish having failed both his master and the master of mankind. Mokir gave the servitor a sideways look and kept coming, straight towards Caleb, one hand resting on the hilt of his combat blade. The housecarl prayed silently.
"Emperor, Lord of Man, protect me and hold me safe against the enemies of your divine will."
In the next second, he was yanked from his feet and felt strong hands pull him off the deck, up and away. Caleb thrashed, coming to face a serious aspect there in the dimness.
"Voyen,"
he whispered. The apothecary put a finger to his lips and held Caleb tightly. The housecarl looked down from the catwalk and watched Mokir run a cursory glance over the alcove below them, then snort and stride back to Grulgor. After a moment, Voyen relaxed his grip and let Caleb settle onto the scaffold.
"Lord,"
whispered the servant,
"what are you doing here?"
Voyen's voice was a low rumble.
"Like you, my suspicions were piqued. And like you, my skills in stealth are of a decent standard."
"Thank you for saving me, sir. If Mokir had found me there..."
"It would not have gone well."
It was clear the apothecary was deeply troubled. Caleb looked back at the loaders and the glass spheres.
"Those orbs, what are they?"
The work gangs were busy detaching the warhead cowlings from thruster-guided glide bombs, exchanging the explosive charges inside for the globes of liquid. Voyen tried to speak, and it was as if the words caught in his throat, too distasteful for him to even bring to bear.
"Those are life-eater capsules," he managed. "It is an engineered viral strain of such complete lethality that it can only be deployed in the most extreme circumstances, usually against the most foul Xenos."
He looked away, and Caleb felt a chill at the warrior's mien. If an Astartes could be fearful of these things...
"It is a bane weapon of the highest order, a world killer. Only the largest capital ships are permitted to carry it in their armories."
"And they brought it from the Endurance?"
Caleb blinked.
"Why, Lord? Why are they loading it to fire on the planet?"
Voyen gave him a hard look.
"Caleb, listen to me. Go to the captain and tell him what we have seen, as fast as you can, little man. Go. Go now."
And so Caleb ran.
"What's this?"
Decius heard the warning tone in Kariah's voice and looked up from the hololithic display and across the frigate's bridge. The shipmaster was speaking to Mars, the vox tender.
"There aren't any scheduled movements in this battle sector. Did the deployment pattern get altered without my knowledge?"
"Negative," said Mars. "No recorded changes, sir. Nevertheless, this signal from the Lord of Hyrus is clear. A craft from the Andronius is on our scopes, and it does not register a mission flight plan."
"The Andronius is Eidolon's ship," said Sendek. "Has he suddenly become eager to join our battle brothers down on the surface?"
"Perhaps the scent of all that glory was too much to resist," added Decius.
Captain Garrow walked back from the far end of the chamber, grimacing a little as he limped.
"Are you sure?"
he asked, addressing his demand to the communications officer. Mars nodded and brandished a data slate.
"Very sure, Captain. An Emperor's Children Thunderhawk is passing through our engagement zone."
"A fine way to get yourself shot down," murmured Sendek, drawing a wry nod from Decius.
The Astartes toggled the hololith to show the data from Mars's report, and his eyes widened. Not only was there a Thunderhawk arrowing through Eisenstein's patch of space, but behind it was a cluster of Raven interceptors, and they were in an attack delta. Garrow was speaking to the woman, Vought.
"Smells like trouble. Put us on an intercept course."
Decius looked to his commander as the deck officer relayed Garrow's orders.
"Lord, Is this some sort of a test? First we are taken off our assigned duty station, and now our own ships are launching without authorization.
I have no answer for you.
Captain, Sendek called out urgently, the fighters trailing the Thunderhawk, they have just opened fire on it.
The shock was clear in his voice.
A warning shot, suggested Karaya.
Vought shook her head.
No, cogitators are detecting energy blooms on the vessel's hull. The dropship is taking hits.
The familiar bell chime sounded once more, and Mas emerged from the alcove again.
Battle Captain Garrow, I have a message sent in the clear on the General Vox channel.
Quickly,
Garrow ordered.
From Lord Commander Eidolon, Starship Andronius. Message reads, Fugitive Thunderhawk is acting against the War Master's commands and is to be considered a renegade. All fleet elements are ordered to destroy the ship on sight.
Shoot down one of our own vessels? Sendek was clearly aghast at the mere thought of such an idea.
Has he taken leave of his senses?
The Thunderhawk is turning, reported the deck officer. He's seen our approach. Confirm, the Thunderhawk is closing in on us.
She looked up at Garrow.
He's well within lascannon range, Lord.
Kariah's face was stony, and a hard silence fell across the bridge.
What are your orders, Captain Garrow?
Decius's commander threw him a look, and then turned to Mas.
Can you get me a ship-to-ship link with that Thunderhawk?
Aye, sir.
Then do it, now.
But, Lord, the orders,
began Decius. Garrow shot the warrior a sharp glare.
Eidolon can give all the orders he wants. I will not fire on a fellow Astartes without first knowing why.
The battle captain strode to the mouth of the Voxhide and snatched a hand communicator from Mas.
Thunderhawk on a closing course with the Eisenstein, he barked. Identify yourself.
Through the crackle of interference came an anxious reply.
Nathaniel?
Decius saw the colour drain from Garrow's face in recognition.
It's Saul. It's good to hear your voice, my brother. Saul Tavis, whispered Sendek, captain of the Emperor's children.
Impossible. He's a man of honour. If he's turned traitor, then the galaxy has gone insane.
Decius found he couldn't look away from Garrow's shocked expression.
Perhaps it has.
It was a long moment before Decius realized the words had been his.